This is Midwest Moxie, a show about our region's visionary entrepreneurs and the experiences that shape them. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute. Jake Jorenstad tried to take a more conventional path, but one potential employer wouldn't give him an interview because his grade point average was a smidge too low. Another knocked him out in the final cut. And the one that hired him laid him off with 20 other employees 8 months later. So Jake founded a company. Fargo-based Bushel provides software products and services to the agricultural industry. It has 200 employees and has raised $75 million of investment funding. Jake, welcome to Midwest Moxie.
Thanks for having me and for taking me through the history.
Right. You and Ryan Ragus, your co-founder, were still in college in 2011 when you started Bushel. What did Bushel look like back then?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy to think about, you know, the last 10, 11 years. We were a different brand. We were under this company called Myriad, M-Y-R-I-A-D. We were building software for anybody who would pay to have us help build software. We tried everything from the 99-cent apps to contracting. It turns out we were better at taking other people's ideas and executing on them than we were on our own for a while. And we got a lot of reps doing that. And we built a team. I think about 20 people were working with us full time or close to it when we graduated from college. So my mom asked me when I was graduating at the ceremony, which I wasn't certain that I was graduating because I think I was between a D and an F on one of my classes that I needed to pass. But thankfully they draw curves and the curve was like really low for me. So it worked out. And my mom asked me if I was going to update my resume and get a job. And I'm like, Mom, like I have employees, like I got to go all in on this. I'm going to do this company.
Well, so, I mean, you've kind of got a theory about that it was lower risk to do it then than it might be later, right?
Well, if you think about like, if you're in your 30s or 40s, you probably get a sense of this already, but like, you have debt and obligations and a house and a mortgage and kids and family and go through the whole list of problems that you have to deal with every day and be able to afford your life. But when you're 20 years old, 21 years old, graduating college, your obligations are minimal. And that's about the best time you could ever take a risk and dive in and try to build something, I think. So that was what I realized kind of after the fact.
You invented a word, flerning. Tell us what flerning means and how it applied to what was going on in the early days of the company.
Well, I think one thing in the Midwest we fear is failure a lot. This idea that we don't really talk about the failures of our family or friends or in entrepreneurs, you don't hear a lot about failures. You hear about successes sometimes and probably not even enough there. But failing, and that's, I think failing is a little harsh. I call it flerning because if you fail, but you learn and then do better on the next iteration or improve, or you don't give up, but you keep going. That's not really failure. Failure is when you give up and end it and you can't do it anymore. And I think entrepreneurs do a lot of flerning, especially the best ones. They learn from their, you know, potential failures, perceived failures, and iterate and pivot and whatever the words you want to use are, and they get better.
Increasingly, you were realizing that Bushel couldn't be everything to everyone, and you needed to find a focus. How did you find Bushel's focus?
Well, we were doing business in every kind of industry. And if you're being honest, when you go to a meeting with a healthcare provider one day, and the next day you're at a manufacturer, and the next day you're at some agriculture co-op, you can't really be good at all those things, like speaking the language, knowing the details of their business. And in software, you kind of have to be contextually right or understanding about what their business is. And we just were doing it for so many different businesses. We weren't ever going to be experts in any one of those areas unless we focused. And so our flerning, though, was we thought, oh, let's pick three major industries to focus on, or actually probably was five at the time: education, manufacturing, and agriculture, as if those are small areas to focus on. But we were so fearful that if we picked too small of a niche, we would fail because the business opportunity wasn't big enough. And that's basically a fallacy of every entrepreneur that they have to deal with. You think if you focus, the market opportunity is smaller and therefore it might not be, the upside might not be there. But as we figured this out and we focused just on agriculture, and even in agriculture, we just are focusing on the row crops and the grain business, co-ops and mills and retailers that sell stuff to farmers as well. When we focus in on that, it was still a huge market to go after. And we realize this now, but it took us like a couple years of evolving to figure out that it's okay to focus on one industry and one area of that industry and be the best that you can be. And when we did that, we kept growing faster.
So a lot of your customers are these grain elevators and farmers growing row crops and that sort of thing. What do you do for them?
So our customer is the grain company, the co-op, the local elevator, the guy who sells seed and fertilizer to the farmer. So they're kind of what we call the middle of the supply chain. And what we do is, you know, before we brought the solution to market, almost every interaction with the farmer was a paper-based interaction or a phone call. So like imagine the 90s in the stock market, you had to call in, put your PIN and ask the guy on the phone to buy some stock for you. That was how you had to buy stock in the 90s. Now we use Robinhood or E-Trade or something, right? Mm-hmm. This is where the grain industry is. They're still in the paper-based human interaction transaction, and it's very inefficient. And currently, the labor issue is real. If you live in a small town in Kansas, you run an elevator, you don't have a lot of employees to choose from, and you're starting to have people retire out of the business and whatever. And so you've done a lot of investment in the physical side. You built these great facilities and you have these trucks and tractors and everything. But now you have to figure out how you're going to get more efficient yet. And usually technology is one of the last areas that you can really invest in. And so we've been helping them give software to their supplier, the farmer. So farmers use our tool. It's called the Bushel app from whatever facility, their brand. And they can see all their transactions, just like you can see your transactions from your bank on your app today. The farmer can see all their transactions with their facility. Everything from their deliveries to how much they're going to get paid to be able to sign contracts, all that has become available through our tools.
But the farmer isn't the one paying you, right?
That's right. And then the facilities and others in the middle of the supply chain are buying it, and then they give it for free to the farmers who they do business with, just like you don't have to pay for your bank app.
So you understand the business of these grain elevators and this sort of thing better than all the people on the coast, for sure. But typically, they have better luck raising investment funding. How did you overcome that?
Well, for a while, it was really hard, right? So two challenges. One is we're from Fargo, and people didn't think you could build a company very big in Fargo where there wasn't enough. We were literally most in the 2018-19 timeframe when I was talking to investors from around the country. They would ask questions like, well, can you get enough software people in Fargo to build a company? And this is like when we're like 50 or 70 employees, let alone 200, right? And then the other problem was, okay, so we're from Fargo, fine. Maybe they can get over that. They're like, well, we don't know anything about agriculture. And I'm trying to convince them that they should invest in this arena. One time I went to New York, I think, or Chicago, and I told them, you know, we sell software to grain elevators, to elevators. And this person had done so little research and understanding of our business. And they said, you know, what kind of elevators do you work with? Is it, you know, Orion or whatever? He's referencing the elevator I came up to the top of their fancy building in, as if that was the same context, right? And there's just like huge gap in knowledge, especially in the venture community. Until recently, ag tech was not a thing, agriculture technology. And so that was two of the challenges. And I went to Silicon Valley, to Sand Hill Road. I couldn't get a meeting for most of the time I was out there. I could not get in the room. I even had entrepreneurs that had been successful with Silicon Valley money and introduced me. And they said, oh, we're just not super interested in that space. They didn't even look at our business. So there was some really difficult times. But what I found is that investors, there's a lot of money, but investors in the Midwest that understood this industry because they grew up here were the more likely candidates. And we found a local group of ag tech mafia. I call them the Ag Mafia of Fargo, to invest early. And then eventually some venture capital groups and others that are in the agriculture space. And then ag tech became a cool thing. And we were in the middle of building our company in the process. And we got a little bit lucky, but it has been difficult. And I have not raised a single dollar from Silicon Valley today. We've raised $75 million.
I'd call that a badge of honor.
Yeah, it feels good now. Back then, it was a little bit hairy.
So you've been very involved in building out the startup ecosystem in Fargo. Do you want to talk a little bit about what you've done there?
Yeah, so I work with a group called Emerging Prairie. My friend Greg is the CEO of Emerging Prairie and has been building it for 10 years now. But him and I started together with a couple of our friends, Andy and Miguel, and we originally, our idea was, well, the news never covers any of these cool startup stories, so let's write news stories about ourselves. And then we're like, well, we only wrote two articles and nobody knows how to really write around here, at least on our team at the time. So we're like, well, this is a bad idea. And then Greg's like, well, I'm going to put some events together and see if people show up. And we did like a founder's drinks, we call it, our startup drinks. And people started showing up. The very first meeting we ever did, we talked about Legos. One of the guys along was selling Legos on eBay. That's where it started, but it built a community of entrepreneurs who could learn from each other. We have this event now called Startup Brew, where like 200 people come on a Wednesday morning and they pitch, the startups pitch their ideas and what they're working on in 5 minutes. And they spend the next 30 minutes with questions from the audience. They run TEDx Fargo, 5,000 people coming to this event, sharing ideas, and they run founders retreats and startup drinks still. And they built this community around entrepreneurship and being okay with failure and learning. And there's been people come and go, but there's been some incredible successes in the last 5 or 10 years here in Fargo. And I give a lot of credit to the Emerging Prairie crew and helping build a community that matters. And I've just been the benefit of it. So.
Well, and you've been involved in putting together Grand Farm. Maybe talk about that briefly.
Yeah. So as the Emerging Prairie team matured, they also realized that, and I think I was still on the board at the time when we suggested that we pursue this idea, we kind of voted on it. Let's focus. What is Fargo's right to be here in the business world? What is our, I think somebody, Barry Batchelor called it, what is our major? Like, what's this region's major? What are we the best at? And we realize it's this merging of agriculture, manufacturing, and technology all in one place. We have built so many tractors, so many machines, Bobcat, Steiger tractor, now Case, John Deere's electronic solutions are being built here in Fargo. And then we've had a lot of software business success. Pario, Bushel, even Microsoft's Great Plains software has been an agriculture product in the past. And we said the merging of all those ideas and the idea of autonomous farming and automated farming is what we potentially could put our stake in the ground and say, hey, this is a place in the world where we're going to do that better than anybody else. And that was what became this thing called the Grand Farm. We had some farmland donated to the organization, and then we've since bought another 160 acres and are building a facility, an innovation facility, collaboration with corporates and startups all over the world, have been coming to Fargo in the last few years, being part of the Grand Farm experiment. We kind of had this idea, like, you know, the Great Gatsby, it's like the future could be great and it's like parties and super, you know, positive in some respects, right? Like the Grand Farm, how do we make this like an amazing future opportunity? And that's where we started from. So we're making progress.
It doesn't hurt that the governor of North Dakota is a successful entrepreneur himself, right?
Yeah, Governor Doug Burgum, he built Great Plains Software, sold to Microsoft for like $1.2 billion in the early 2000s, went on to be the chairman of SuccessFactors, sold SAP for $4 billion. And if you remember, if you're a software developer, you know this tool called Atlassian, this company called Atlassian, Jira, and other software tools. He was a chairman and helped take them public for $20 billion. So like, this guy's done it. He's our governor. He's a big supporter of Grand Farm and all the things we're doing. And his family owns one of the big egg companies in the state. So, you know, he comes from the farm too.
What's your hope for Bushel? How big do you think it can get?
Our goal is to be the biggest and most impactful software business in agriculture in the United States. Software, it's important. We don't sell grain or buy grain. We don't sell fertilizer. See, we build software for the ag industry broadly over time here. And we've been connecting this infrastructure with the digital form of what's needed to be successful. And our dream is that we are the most, you know, we're the fundamental infrastructure for what the next 100 years in agriculture looks like. That means we're making it more efficient, effective. And if we do our mission really well, that means we'll have less hunger in the world and less war, and people won't go to bed hungry. And that's a worthy cause. So if we can do our job to help these companies be more efficient at getting food to the world, then we'll be happy.
Thanks so much for taking the time to tell your story.
Thanks for having me and letting me share.
You can read more about today's guest by visiting WUWM.com. Don't forget, you can also listen to the show as a podcast if you'd like to take us on the go. Just search for Midwest Moxie wherever you listen to your podcasts. This is Midwest Moxie, a show about our region's visionary entrepreneurs and the experiences that shape them. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute. Julia Ragan wasn't drawn into launching a startup by childhood dreams of entrepreneurship or the allure of making it big. 8 years at a large pharmaceutical company, then five more at other startups, showed Julia the difference technology could make in bringing better, cheaper care to patients. So in 2020, she decided to launch a company to improve the complicated process of starting a patient on specialty medications. New Albany, Indiana-based RX Lightning has grown to 36 employees and raised $8.5 million of funding. Julia, welcome to Midwest Moxie.
Thanks, Kathleen, for having me today.
Specialty medications are more complicated and expensive. They're typically needed by patients with chronic diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, or cancer. RX Lightning streamlines the process of getting a patient on these medications. How do you do that?
Well, these medications cost thousands, tens of thousands of dollars a month. And they're, because of the cost to the insurance companies and the U.S. healthcare system, there's a lot of complicated processes along the way, from insurance authorizations to exchange of clinical information to ensure that it's being used appropriately for a condition, to then affordability components, just because even somebody that's well off would struggle to pay for these medications. So along that journey, there's multiple different steps of the process, but all of these are traditionally paper-based, manual, faxes, phone calls that occur. So what RX Lightning has done is we've taken that entire journey of process and paperwork and created a digital experience that helps provider offices and healthcare systems automate the journey and what's next, as well as connect the provider to the patient and the specialty pharmacies and the drug manufacturers and other destinations across the patient journey to transfer information back and forth and create visibility into the process. So when I look at the world of ordering pizza, I could call Papa John's and know exactly where my pizza is and when it's going to arrive to my house. That's what we want to do for getting patients on specialty medications, create an experience that everybody that's working through the process, because of how complicated it is, knows what the other person's doing and where they're at through that process.
So who's your customer? Is it who pays you for doing this?
We work with the drug manufacturers and their support organizations, as well as the specialty pharmacies. So those are our two primary partners. And then our platform is free to providers to use. However, there are sometimes paid models when we're working on different workflow automations that have different business rules based upon the healthcare system or provider's office as well.
Is this a problem just in the U.S. healthcare industry or outside the U.S.?
The U.S. is definitely more complicated than other parts of the globe. However, when you look at some of the medications and the distribution, just because it's a finite set of patient population, there is some of the similar issues across the globe. It's definitely not as complex, though, as the U.S. healthcare journey, just because of the insurance companies that put a lot of red tape in the way to restrict access to medications.
One of the interesting things to me about your startup is I wouldn't have even known this was a problem. I wouldn't have had the visibility. And I assume it's a big problem because these people stay on these medications for a long time. So I can see why it's worth doing what you're doing. But let's talk about the background you have that allowed you to even identify this problem. You spent 8 years at Novo Nordisk, the Danish multinational pharmaceutical company. What did you do there? That was where you started with this, right?
Yeah, well, I started as a pharmaceutical rep, like a lot of kids out of college, and I thought I was working my way up in the sales channel. So I did a rotation in-house in New Jersey that was supposed to be focused on digital marketing. And when I went in, e-prescribing and EHRs were in the infancy, and they asked me to explore how they were going to impact Novo at the time.
Can I just jump in? And EHR is electronic health records, right?
Yes, yes. So at this point in time, the Epic giant that is today was early on in their evolution of providers using it. So the market was extremely fragmented, and there was really no one on the drug manufacturer side looking at it. And I just fell in love with the opportunity that I thought technology would create. Like, if we think about it, 10 years ago, the banking industry, a lot of things were digital, but healthcare was still on paper charts, or the most of it was on paper charts. So
and help us all, faxes, right?
Yeah, well, right. And faxes are still today the one of the number one ways people communicate in healthcare is with a fax, which is just so antiquated. But there's a lot of room for innovation and technology improvements just because of the sensitivity of the data that we're talking about with patient level data. So we're still in our infancy of technology.
But you had to be in the belly of the beast to understand where all the issues were and the opportunities. So then you left Novo Nordisk to work at startups. And I just get the sense you were pulled along. The more you worked in this industry, the more you wanted to innovate, the more you got toward starting your own company. What kept pulling you like that?
I think it's just my nature is to really dive deep and fast. And I think that when you are in a larger organization and you're somebody that's kind of following the spear and not directing the spear, for someone like me, I was drawn towards trying to get to the point where I was directing. And with the innovation, there's been many products that I've been fortunate enough with myself and my teams around me to bring to market and really impact healthcare, a lot of which happen across the journey of a specialty medication. And because of all that experience, it just brought me to a point where I had great mentors around me, great founders that previously exited that were mentoring me as well, that just said, Julie, you have a great idea, great strategy. Why don't you attempt to build a company yourself? And at that point, I was like, yeah, I could do this from a business perspective. And then fortunately, I had people around me that helped us raise our initial rounds of capital, because that I didn't know how to do when I first started off.
Well, so maybe you were clueless about some of that, but you were very deliberate about how you started how you launched the company and what your plan was for the company. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah. So because of my experience, I knew exactly what the strategy was. I knew that paper was being used. I knew that even when there were digital solutions out there, it was for one part of the process or one drug. And I knew it wasn't just efficient. And when you look at the market, specialty drugs, it's a small percentage of the population of patients that need it. It's only about 3%, but it's over 50% of the drug spend in the U.S. So it's supposed to grow to over $1 trillion in the next couple of years, which is being driven by these specialty rare disease drugs. So when you look at the market and you know it's growing, there's a huge opportunity. And I knew exactly what to build. And luckily I had a brilliant co-founder, Brad Allen, who is an amazing architect and engineer. And he joined the journey with me, and we were able to really define the product and the solution that we knew would solve the challenges in this space. And we focused most of 2020 just building the product. And then we did a soft launch in 21 and started gaining some traction. And today we're in the market officially a full year and working with some of the largest specialty pharmacies and some of the largest drug manufacturers, and some of the largest healthcare systems are using us. And I think the thing that is most exciting for me is I go back to my original business plan. And there's definitely differences, and we've grown and expanded our solution and our ecosystem that we were going to approach, but it's still very much similar to the strategy that we're deploying and executing on today.
What are the advantages and disadvantages you've learned about founding a company in the Midwest?
Well, I think that the disadvantages are you've got to go find investors, right? I think for me, the 2020 helped because I didn't have to travel anywhere. So that was beneficial with the investment. One of the biggest advantages is the Midwest traditionally has a lower cost of living than when you're looking at the major cities on the coast. And because of that, you've got great talented individuals here that, because the cost of living is lower, you could afford to hire more of, and you just preserve your cash in your runway. Not only is it the people, but if you have an office location or anything like that, it's just lower cost of living. So I think that's one of the advantages that a lot of people don't look at when they're investing in the Midwest. I think that some of the other benefits are there are a lot of, at least in the healthcare space, there are a ton of large healthcare companies in the Midwest that people just don't realize that they're there. For us, when we look at our market specifically, Louisville, everybody knows Humana's here. What people don't necessarily know is United Health Group's Optum specialty pharmacies here. There's Bright Spring Health, which has a specialty pharmacy here. There's several manufacturer support programs that are local that we work with. So it's actually, if I stepped back and picked a location, of course I could go to Jersey. Of course I could go to Silicon Valley and be there. But if I was looking at a market based upon not those two with a lot of potential clients, Louisville coincidentally has a ton of those individuals right around us.
When you think about RX Lightning, you know, now you're a couple years in, what kind of potential does it have?
You know, I think that it has really great potential. When I look at the market, the market is enormous. It's going to grow. The problem's not going to go away. It's just going to get worse. The offices and people really love our platform. It's super simple to use. And I think it's up to us to kind of create the destiny and execute on the plan to continue to grow. But I think when I look at it, it more comes back to impact around leaving the healthcare industry and bringing it into the 21st century and creating a more digital experience to help providers and patients. And if RX Lightning achieves the goals around achieving our mission and helping get patients on therapy quicker, all the financial goals and expectations that people have on us will be there.
You can read more about today's guest by visiting WUWM.com. Don't forget, you can also listen to the show as a podcast if you'd like to take us on the go. Just search for Midwest Moxie wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher. Midwest Moxie was created by executive producer Audrey Nowakowski and me. Today's episode was produced by Audrey Nowakowski. Join us next Sunday at 7 p.m. to hear from more visionary Midwestern founders building innovative companies. That's right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.